Welcome to Success Beneath the Surface, hosted by Deborah Fell, Managing Partner at Chief Outsiders. Deborah provides insights specifically for CEOs from growth-oriented companies. Today, Deborah is joined by Tori Carter-Conning, CEO of the American Society of Landscape Architects.
Thank you, Susan. Hi, Tori. Great to have you here today. I've heard so much about you from Tom McCrary, partner and chief marketing officer for Chief Outsiders. And that was before I reviewed your background. So I know you're CEO of American Society of Landscape Architects, and you've had other significant positions, such as CEO of American Immigration Lawyers Association, just for example. I know you know that the audience for this podcast is primarily CEOs like yourself, and it would be great if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got from there, where you started, to where you are today.
Wow, well, it's a pleasure, Deborah. It's so good to talk to you. That's always such an interesting question to be asked. The first thing I'll say is I was chief operating officer of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just in case the actual CEO is listening.
Yeah. He probably knows you were running the show anyway. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
That's hilarious. He and I are very close and still friends. So how I got started, I mean, I got started at an association almost 30 years ago at this point. My first association job was when I was 20, I'm sorry. I wasn't even able to drink at the first holiday party.
A key milestone for any of us.
I mean, it's the one thing I remember about starting there is starting right before the holiday party and couldn't drink. I started at the American Society for Industrial Security. It's an association here in Alexandria, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what associations were at the time or what they necessarily did. And I started off in the accounting department. I was a bookkeeper. So very sort of basic, generic job. But I found that I spent more of my time sort of being curious about all the other things that the organization did, principally around membership and engaging with people. And it's where I really sort of began to understand the sort of magic of associations and the sort of interesting space that they sit in between.
Can you talk about that a little bit more, the magic?
It's really interesting because I think, if you think about the sort of typical groups of organizations or types of organizations, and people usually talk about them in terms of for-profit versus nonprofit or government. And the beautiful thing about associations is that they're sort of a Venn diagram of all three. There's this professional group of people that have a particular shared interest, common interests that they all agree on. They're all different folks. They probably practice differently, but they have this association based on their professional work. And the beautiful part about an association is that they advocate for that group of people's interest. But it's also has sort of for-profit tendencies because we have, programs and services that we have that we provide and produce publications and events. And, so the P&L and sort of market principles come into it as well, right? Because we have our customers are our members and we have to keep them happy and engaged and satisfied. And so there's a for-profit component to the work as well. And then obviously the government piece, right? Working on policy and engaging on legislation. And so it's just a really interesting mix of work that is unique to associations that after working, to your point of sort of how I got there, I've kind of dabbled in each of those areas over the course of the last 25 years. And I kind of, I left the first association after 10 years, cut my teeth there, then went and worked for a CPA firm for some time. Then I worked at a private transportation management company, one of the largest counties in the country, Fairfax County here in Virginia. And I was the controller, still sort of, on paper, you would think it would be a numbers job, right? But I spent most of my time engaging with the different stakeholders. So I kind of sat between the county who had a particular interest, and then we had my company, who was bottom line driven and how are we making the most profitability. And so to be able to sort of have a business mindset, but also an ability to communicate and listen and understand the interest of different parties coming from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Should also mention there was a third party, there's a union that was a part of that as well. So all three of those interest groups, if you will, sort of sitting in the middle of them and being able to translate and understand and create partnerships to provide the best service and product for the citizens of Fairfax County, you know, that's when it really started to sort of settle for me about, like, this is an interesting space that I'm enjoying, right? The sort of ability to pull from different parts of both trained skill set and education skill set, but also just enjoying problem solving with people, because that's the hairiest part, right? It's the, how do you get people that have some shared interests, but also divergent interests to align and move in the same direction together?
So some people, given that complexity, because that is massive complexity with all these different interests, some getting to shared could cause some people to run screaming and saying, this role served me well, you know, but after 10 years, I have had it, I'm done.
Yeah.
What is it about you that causes you to sort of not just hang in there, but to actually have this be such a passion and a consistent commitment to stand in the brink of all those different voices?
I generally enjoy the problem solving and the sort of complexity of it just naturally. It's just sort of part of how I'm wired. But I would also say that I enjoy doing it and I continue to step into it for organizations that have a purpose or a mission that I believe in.
Ah, okay.
Right? So that's kind of a critical piece.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't say that every, as we all do, right, when you're sort of cutting your teeth and figuring out, you know, where you are, you know, can bring your best talent to different organizations. I didn't always understand how important mission and purpose was to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because theoretically, the things we just described are transferable. Mm-hmm. Those are skill sets that can be transferred to one organization from the other. And frankly, there are nuances between for-profit, nonprofit, and government. But the things I described, engaging with people, aligning on strategy and all those things, all three of those entities, those organizational types, have to do that.
Right.
What I'm driven most by is the mission and purpose part. So, you know, when you think about the American Society of Landscape Architects and our mission and purpose of advocating for and protecting the environment and designing beautiful, sustainable, resilient spaces for everyone, that's part of my value set. It's what I believe in when I'm not on the clock. Right. When I'm not sort of doing my day job, I believe in that as a value set. I believe in what makes this country so amazing is the contributions from people from all over that have made this place the unique, amazing country that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so going to an organization that sort of holds this amazing responsibility for that made sense, because it made sense to me before the job. And so, you know, all the way we're going backwards, but Center for American Progress, same thing. Advocating for and training and helping to elect LGBTQ people to be more representative in public office. I mean, those are things that absolutely align with my value set. And so being able to do that for a living, to sort of help those causes and also, you know, advance as a professional, spot on.
So you don't just have jobs, you have missions.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. So where did this come from? Go back to somewhere in time. And when did that arise in you? Was that something you saw in your parents? Was that something you had a role model out there somewhere? Where did it come from and how did it grow?
Both role model and my parents. It's interesting when I thought about this over the years. My mother was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I have an uncle who was in the military. I have another aunt of mine who, you know, worked in government service.
Yes.
And my grandmother was the grandmother that many of us had, right? She was the one who was the first person to console someone or do something for the community if a person passed away. She would make the casserole. She was the one who would offer people, invite people into our home who didn't have things. And so she was always of service, be it through church or be it through just through the community, a network of friends that she had. And, you know, at the, when you're a kid, you don't really understand what you're doing or why you're doing it.
Yes.
Why are we making food for all these other people? You know, you know, and you're like 5 and 6. You're like, why do I have to do this? Why are we doing this? But it was absolutely that sort of, it's part of the DNA, right? It's part of the makeup of who we are, who our family is. Even to this day, we still, it's one of the most consistent, proud things that we do as a family.
Yes.
And you all know families have their, you know, families are funny.
Yes. That's a good way to put it, Tori.
Yeah. But we still have this service-oriented mindset. So that is the thing that I would point back to, that sort of, it's always been part of our family's mission to help other people or to believe in something and then fully go all the way in on it.
And do you think they see in you the legacy that they have handed?
That's a really interesting, I mean, it's the answer is yes. It's odd to think about it that way, right? Yeah, because you hope, everyone hopes that their family and their grandparents and parents are proud of them.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandmother's no longer with me, so that's also why it's a little, But yeah, I know she is, and I know my mother is, and our family, they absolutely see themselves in the work, you know.
So you have family members in government services, in military service, in education service, which is perhaps has its own front line, you know, to deal with. These are sacrificial roles, and grandmothers are totally sacrificial in terms of their, you can't outgive grandma. I don't believe it's possible. But these are all sacrificial roles, not as well paid, for lack of a better word, not as well appreciated in the public sector as they should be, just in my view. But yet they gave and they gave, and you saw all this and you set upon your own path to continue giving and just got really committed to the missions for other people, for our country, but in different ways than your parents and grandmother and mentor did.
Yes. And even and now my mother works at a hospital. And so you know, in our day-to-day grind, all of us are busy and doing things and raising kids and the whole bit. You don't, I don't think about it in that way often, but you know, when you give me the time to sit and think about it, and it's a great question to reflect on. It really does. It's not an accident that this has happened this way. Yeah, it's really good.
So how does this play out? Because being of service, I hear that all day long now from you, the commitment. When you're running an enterprise, an institution, these businesses, you likely don't get to be just of service in everything you do all day long. How does that work? How do you view your role? How are you who you are in that role?
CEOs need help growing their companies, but don't always have the time or money to hire a full-time chief marketing officer, CMO, or chief sales officer, CSO, or both. Recruiting a quality full-time executive can take months, not to mention the ongoing cost. In these challenging times, CEOs need battle-tested growth executives who can help companies successfully navigate the uncertain waters. Partner with chief outsider CMOs and CSOs who will function as strategic operators to build and execute your growth engines. And we're back with Tori and Deborah.
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'll slightly push back because the approach, because I think even in the most difficult times, making the most difficult decision, I'm still of service to someone or something. For example, everything we do at the organization is, and in my role, is being of service to the membership, right? That's principle, right? And so whether that means making personnel decisions that are difficult or required, that's in service of the membership. If it means, you know, sunsetting a line of business to start a new one, reallocating resources, exploring new partnerships, all in service of the members. We've part of our strategic plan that we went through a few years ago. You know, it's got all the, you know, all the things that all of CEOs love, right? It's got outcomes and milestones, and we have new vision, values, and mission, and all those great things. But ultimately, it all boils down to we are a member-first organization, which means that all of these lines of business, all of these things that we're doing, every decision point that we're making has to be in service of and for the betterment of the organization, the members, and the profession. And that's hard, you know, because the perception isn't always, particularly depending on the decision or if it's something that's really hard, it's not always perceived that it's in service of, right? It could be perceived that it's in service of me, or it's in service of some small constituency group, it's in service of the board. But the reality is that all of it rolls up to how are we setting this organization up to be the best provider of and representative of this great profession.
Yeah.
In some ways, this sort of history of service and being service-minded completely rolls up into my role as CEO. In fact, it becomes the ultimate responsibility, right? I mean, I think when you have more junior roles, you can sort of be more transactional or sort of you can operate within a particular line of business or function.
Yeah.
When you get to these roles, you know, we have a principal group of people that we have to constantly be thinking about.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, I talk to a lot of folks who can talk mission, vision, values, implementation. Mm-hmm. And I don't judge, you know, I'm not in the position to judge how that really plays out on a day-to-day basis, but how you're speaking, you know, you really seem to speak through the implementation and every decision as you referred to. So we know part of the difference is just what you grew up with and how you've, you know, remained committed to serve throughout your life. But how do you remain true to the vision, mission, values in those hard decisions where perhaps the more financially beneficial might be this decision, but you know the better enduring decision is that one, or whatever there's always conflict involved in these decisions. How do you keep your eye on the mission, vision, values, and keep the whole organization and all your constituencies in that direction? Or does sometimes you have to say, okay, guys, I'm going to call it, we still have to go this way?
Both, right? that's the other hard part, right? Is that there at the end of the day, somebody has to decide.
Yes.
And the how I sort of stay true to our values or keep my eye on the ball is, I think one of the things that's key for any CEO, and particularly for me, and it's helped me be successful, is kind of keeping the intersection of all of the components of the business and the organization front of mind. And to constantly, it's probably the most exhausting part of the job, right? Is to constantly, you're constantly rotating through your mind all of the different things that you do as an organization, and the timing and the cadence of it, and paying attention to the organization's kind of the invisibleness thing, like of culture, which is really having a firm understanding of the pace and speed by which an organization and all those stakeholders that you mentioned can absorb and move through change.
Yes.
Which means that you really have to be in constant communication with all of those stakeholders and getting information and inputs from all of those people in order to make sure that you add a little gas, take away a little gas.
Right.
Stop sometimes even in order to give people that you need to get aligned, the space to get aligned. Now, the other critical part of that is you don't have an infinite amount of time for everyone to get on board. And so there is this sort of decision-making, and it's easier to make that decision and move people through when you're paying constant attention to them and listening to them and taking information from the board, from stakeholders, from members, from the staff, from your other industry allies and partners, other CEOs, to sort of keep sort of moving the sails a little bit to move us and keep us going in the right direction. And sometimes you have to be comfortable with imperfect information. And just do it. I found that if you've spent enough time nurturing and listening to all of those people and explaining why you're doing what you're doing, and you're clear on mission, vision, and values, and you built up what I call the emotional capital that people of trust, that people will, even if they don't necessarily agree, they won't question that you're in service of the greater good of the organization. They may not agree with it. They might think that you made the decision too quickly, but they're more likely to give you the benefit of the doubt that you considered all of these things, and they'll respect your decision and the need for someone to make the decision.
So it is truly the trust equation. It's the commitment to vision, mission, values, this additional ingredient that you put in, that is the communication around the capability for implementation. And not just a conversation about closing the gap, but a conversation about recognizing when there is any gap and modifying speed. What gear can we be in right now to really do this full on?
And that's continuous. I mean, you said it, that's so well said. Yeah. And that's not a transactional thing. That's not a, we're at this moment and now we're going to engage and figure out the gaps. That's an ongoing process. And it's ongoing and it's dynamic because it's ongoing with different groups. And so you have all of these sort of things sort of rotating around each other. And your job as CEO is to watch it all and decide that's the moment. We've talked about it enough. We've had enough discussion. Everyone's had enough input. Go.
So there's a decision-making capability. I've heard this expression, there's alignment, but alignment does not mean we're finding the lowest common denominator upon which we can all agree. You're really speaking to the leadership of identifying when do we have enough information? When do we have enough alignment? When do we have enough just sheer knowledge and experience to say, let's go, and, yes. and then make it happen, and then own the outcome of all this?
Yes. And there's a phrase I picked up. I don't know if it originated there, but I was reading an article years ago about Jeff Bezos. And apparently he had this, it was talking about how he meets and gets information from his team and et cetera, et cetera. And it was fine. But the main takeaway I took from it was he has this policy of, it's called disagree and commit, which means I've used it, you know, I'm sure ad nauseum to some of my team, which is basically, I'm going to give you every opportunity as a team here to say, whatever you think, you can disagree, tell me all the better alternatives. But at the end of the day, if everyone has had an opportunity to participate, when those doors open and the decision is made, when the doors open from the meeting, you commit to the outcome. You don't go to the water cooler and say, I didn't vote for that. Or I didn't want to do that. Yeah. You have to commit to it. And that's really difficult to live and sort of operationalize and make it, but it is absolutely one of the drivers, I believe, of a successful team.
Yes.
And our ability to truly be in service of our members. Like we don't have the bandwidth, resources, or time to have divergent strategies or objectives.
Yes. So I'll just say, and there have been so many opportunities here during this discussion where I felt like this is the close. There's nothing that can be said after this. And then, here's another great one. And so I think this could go on and on, but I do respect you have all those people waiting for you to get them to disagree and commit. But I do have to ask you, you know, we're at a period of time where there's been a lot less certainty in the past, and there still is uncertainty. But everything I'm hearing and reading is that 2024 is a time to run. I'm hearing that. I don't know if you're hearing that as well. What would your advice be to other CEOs for now, when potentially it is decide and go? It is disagree and commit time.
I agree with you. It is time to just hit the gas, right? But it assumes that during the time of over the last year or last 18 months that you've decided not to go, that you've also been information gathering, that you've been getting enough information so that when you are ready or when the conditions do change, you are then ready to go. Mm-hmm. So it assumes that work has been done over the last, while we were kind of in this iffy kind of whole what's going to happen phase, that you actually were still collecting information. Mm-hmm. So, but if you haven't done that, I would still say quickly do that.
Yes.
And then I would say, you don't have a lot of time to go. So figure out what are the possibilities of this not working.
Yes.
Mitigate for those.
Yes.
As best you can.
Yes.
And then go. And make sure that everyone understands what those possible outcomes could be. This is how this could go wrong. I've thought about this. This is what could happen here. This is the best option. This could still not go completely as planned. And if it doesn't, we're going to fail fast, or this is the alternative. This is the financial, personnel, strategic implication of it not working.
Yes.
But we don't have a choice. The option can't be to do nothing anymore.
Yes.
Because my sense is, my guess is that all of those CEOs, all the folks who are listening on this podcast, we're all in the mindset of thinking about, if we don't go now, A, when are we going to go? And B, folks who are in the same space as us are going.
Yeah.
So we're going to be left behind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what a perfect endpoint on this. And I'll just add something more is that I mentioned Tom McCrary at the beginning of this, and he has worked with you for years, and he and I have worked together for years. So I have heard all the wonderful things about you essentially being the embodiment of just an amazing leader who is able to push the button and go and make things happen, align the organization. These are all things that books are written about, more YouTube videos on the planet, people do webinars, seminars, how to be a great leader, how to be a great leader. But you have really created your own version of that leadership. And so I can only agree with Tom on that point and say thank you for bringing that to the audience today. And I'm just delighted to have you here. Thank you so much, Tori.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Deborah. And I share your love for Tom. He's amazing.
Yes, I agree. All right. Well, thanks again. And
Absolutely. We
will continue on bringing forward big insights from CEOs such as yourself. But I got to tell you, this has been an awesome one. So thank you, Tori.
Thank you, Deborah.
Be sure to subscribe in all your favorite podcast apps. Just look for Success Beneath the Surface. Chief Outsiders, part-time growth executives with full-time results.